It is a great pleasure to welcome to the conversation Paul Launces. Paul founded Launces Asset Management in October 2000. He has about three decades of experience in the investment industry, including Royce & Associates and Ruane Cunniff. As many of you will know and appreciate, Paul has shared his wisdom and insights with our members in the past. And Paul, I'm very grateful that you're taking some time to share your perspective in this quite unique moment in history that we're all living through. I'd love to just have you set the stage for us and share your assessment with our members.
First of all, thank you, John, for the opportunity to speak with you. And I have an enormous respect for MOI and all the products and services you provide. So thank you for that. Second, I just want to offer our prayers and thoughts for everyone out there across the globe that's suffering from the virus and the economic impacts from the virus that's impacting their family so severely. But first of all, for the well-being of everyone out there first, and then secondarily for the economic consequences. Having said all that, I think it's a very, very scary and uncertain time. There's a lot we don't know about the virus and what's going on. It has all kinds of, significant derivative effects behind the healthcare issue, which clearly is most important and most prominent. But I just think there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And so I'm just very, very concerned about, what could happen. I just read last evening that Cheesecake Factory, run by David Overton, that I followed, we don't own it, but I followed it for years, announced, and they've historically had a clean balance sheet, although they've bought a few hundred million of stock over the last few years, announced that they're not going to be able to pay their April rent. They're in the Short Hills Mall, I think owned by Taubman, who's going to be bought by, I think, Simon Group. I think they have a deal, and the King of Prussia Mall. They're in some of the best malls in the country. And many of their stores, I think the average might even be $10 million a store, and they're an anchor tenant. And it just really, it creates a lot of trepidation and fear when a company like that, with, not huge amounts of long-term debt, certainly they have operating leases for their rents, but they can't pay their rent in April. So it's just a very scary time, John, and reverberating throughout the markets. And we can talk further about the equity and the credit markets, but my biggest concern, again, outside of the health of everyone, is the credit markets. I don't think people have addressed, we've talked about it in our year-end letters. I think the credit markets are really going to be challenged going forward. The mortgage REITs in general, there's just so much leverage out there. And I just think that's an enormous powder keg that really concerns me.
Well, thank you, Paul, for setting the stage. I'd love to hear about what you are doing in this time period to protect your clients' portfolios.
That's a great question, John. We prepared a letter that I'd be happy to send to you that we'll be emailing our clients and sending to our clients along with our year-end letter. It's a separate letter regarding COVID-19 and what we're doing. We're really fortunate, John. We have the technology and the capabilities here to work remotely from anywhere. And as you know, our headquarters are in Wyomissing, PA, but we have a New York City office where a couple of us spend all our time, the majority of our time. And that capability has really helped us. We've got our, I think it's our fourth file server last summer. So we've really leveraged technology over the years. And so we're prepared technologically for our company to deal with this. Having been through, I guess, John, it's one of the few benefits of being old. We've been through bear markets in the past, over the past 35 years. I got in the business with Chuck Royce, as you mentioned, in 1989. And we've weathered each of those storms. And historically, what we've done, John, is we've really focused on really outstanding companies with sustainable competitive advantages and long histories of being able to adapt to various environments. Part of that because they've had strong balance sheets and solid business models to really be able to withstand difficult times. We also, if you look at our portfolios, we also believed in what Ben Graham would say about having portions in equity and portions in fixed income, and go wherever the greater opportunity is. And so we've done that. And if you look at our equity holdings, we typically only own 10 to 15 stocks. Berkshire Hathaway is our largest. They have a Fort Knox balance sheet. Cash is over $220 billion. They have over $200 billion in equities, diversified revenues from from a broad range of companies that operate in insurance and railroads, utilities, consumer products. Another big holding, Google, has over $100 billion in cash. We also own Bank of New York, which is really a custodian, one of the largest in the world, and most of its revenues are fee-based as opposed to lending. And then we really feel, even though, you know, everyone's concerned, we own a little bit of Truist and then U.S. Bank and Bancorp and Wells. We think they have among the strongest balance sheets, great credit cultures. PepsiCo has over 23 brands with $1 billion in sales. And then Brown & Brown, LabCorp, Martin Marietta, Progressive, United Health. They're all companies that certainly are going to be challenged in this environment. But we think they have leading positions in each of their, you know, industries, and they have very strong balance sheets. I would also add, John, part of it, because we reasonably concentrate, and we, in many cases, we manage a large portion of our clients' liquid net worth, in some cases, all of it. We've never owned any energy stocks. We own no current lodging, airlines, casinos, cruise companies, travel-focused enterprises, car auto companies. We just don't own any of them. And frankly, I don't know if we ever have. And again, it's not because we had any foresight from this terrible thing. It's just those are industries that concern us. And energy I've looked at for 30 years, and when I've done the analysis, after you screen for low debt levels, low finding costs, low fully loaded, good capital allocated management, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you do all that analysis in energy, both oil and gas, you eliminate really 80, 90% plus or more of the companies in the industry, the biggest being the debt levels. And but even after you do that and you come up with a couple of great companies, when you do the valuation work, or when we do, Zachary and I, when we do the valuation work, Zach, Mike, and I, the valuation typically comes down to the price of the commodity. And we just don't know how to discern with any degree of certainty what that commodity price will be. And a good example is Cabot Oil and Gas. It's an extraordinary company in the Marcellus, great management, low finding costs, good balance sheet. But the price of gas could stay under $2 for the next 5 years. It's very hard to make money. So as a result, John, that's one industry we've avoided for those reasons. And so we think we're reasonably well positioned for almost any environment. And over the last, I would say, John, 3 years, it's in my letters, we have consistently reduced our equity holdings, primarily due to valuation concerns. So our client portfolios at year end were about 40% equity and 60% fixed income. And our fixed income holdings, John, are primarily fixed adjustable preferreds. We came upon those in 2012 and 13. And we sold all our munis and corporates at that time. We thought their risk levels were higher and the yields were much, much lower. And they didn't have interest rate protection the way these fixed adjustable preferreds do with the back end. If they go past the callable date, they have to pay us three-month LIBOR plus whatever the back end is. Now, the back end varies. Some have back ends of only, I think, two of our 20 or so have back ends under 3%. Most are in the 3 to 4.5% range, roughly. So that's what we've owned. And many of the fixed income holdings, John, even the fixed adjustables, they're all investment grade. We own some of the best financial institutions, and they're almost all financial. They are all financial institutions. So we've tried to reduce our risk there by not owning any Goldman, Morgan Stanley, Barclays, Citigroup. Even though they're probably all fine, we wanted to stay with the stronger institutions historically. And many of those holdings have declined because of the credit issues that I've raised. But we think they have strong balance sheets and they'll be able to weather the economic challenges. Plus, they're providing yields from 3% all the way up to 10%, so which is particularly attractive in this low-rate environment. Plus, the dividends are qualified, which provide the tax benefits as they're taxed at capital gains as opposed to ordinary income. And so those are, you know, some of the things we're trying to do, John. And then we wanted to remind our clients, as difficult a time as this is, typical markets have declines of about 5% three times a year, 10% every 6 months, and 20% every 7 years. Now, the 20% are, we had some close calls August, September, October of 11, and back in 18, September to December of 18, particularly December of 18, it was very close to 20 for the S&P decline, but it wasn't really sustained and it really didn't hit exactly 20. So only now after 11 years have we really hit what may be a sustained market decline, even though it's gone up the last few days. And what's interesting, again, if you don't need the capital, and as gut-wrenching as this is, we put together a table that we included in that letter that showed the peak and trough drawdowns, and then the peak and trough, and then it showed what forward returns were for 1 year, 3 years, and 5 years. And the numbers are pretty terrific if you can withstand these difficult times. And the final point I would make, John, that we would convey regarding our firm is, this is a clear black swan. It's frightening, again, primarily the health issue for all people out there globally, and then secondarily the economic damage it's doing. But this is the time, John, to really stay disciplined, focused, and patient, to exploit opportunities that are coming about now and may continue to come about after an 11-year bull market. We have purchased several securities in the last few weeks, many of which are down 30 to 40% from their highs, and they could go further. So we began nibbling, and rather than buying 5 and 6% initial positions, we've been buying 2%, 3% to have additional dry powder to buy further should that happen. And we want to convince our clients that we think we're well positioned. There's a lot of fear and uncertainty out there. We understand it. But it's during these difficult times when investing is most challenging and gut-wrenching that the most attractive opportunities are available to generate future long-term gains.
Paul, a question on fixed adjustable preferreds that you just mentioned. Could you tell us a little bit more about those, because we don't hear about them every day? What exactly do they do within a portfolio, and what are some examples of companies that have issued them?
Fixed adjustable preferreds, John, have been issued. They're very small amounts of most of the bank's capital structures, and they are available in industrials and others. But the great preponderance of fixed adjustable preferreds have been issued by the major banks around the country. And there's really two types. The $25 ones that you can buy directly as an investor, and the $1,000 ones that you have to go through an investment bank or a broker-dealer, Schwab or TD Ameritrade. And there are a small portion of the capital structure of the big banks. And what happens is they were issued because they're considered part of Tier 1 capital. And it's another lever for banks to have some more equity capital, some more capital on their balance sheets. And they began getting issued over a decade ago, many, many years ago. Our first purchases were, I believe, 2012 and 2013 when we started buying them. So we own several $25 ones that are considered retail and several $1,000 ones. And as I mentioned, and I'll talk a little bit about the specifics, but most of the ones we own State Street, Bank of New York, which are custodians, majority of their revenues fee-based as opposed to lending. We own Wells Fargo, we own JP Morgan, we own PNC. Those are the largest blocks we own, both in $25 ones and $1,000 ones. And what's unique about them is, as long as the credit culture and credit quality of banks stay solid, you get paid, and oftentimes at par, a very, very nice coupon, ranging, you know, from 450, 495, all the way to 798. And many of them we've bought at par, some below par, and some a little above par, because those are still very attractive yields. But the majority of the market, John, the majority of the market is purchased. The majority of the market is only pure fixed rate preferreds. They don't have the back end. We do not own any that are fixed only. We own a couple that are purely perpetual, but we don't own any that are fixed only and perpetual. Virtually all of the ones we own are fixed adjustable, meaning when the call date comes 5 or 10 years after issuance, if they don't call the security, they have to pay us 3-month LIBOR plus a back end, which I mentioned earlier. In most cases, not all, but in most cases, probably 90% of our cases, it's 3, 3.5%, all the way up to 4, 4.5%, plus 3-month LIBOR, which is now, I think, 1.19 or so off the top of my head. So it's a very attractive yield, and it protects you, John. If you own a fixed only and rates would go up, and certainly people aren't thinking about that now, but if rates would go up now, you're really not protected. The principal value of your bond, of your fixed preferred, is clearly going to go down meaningfully if you wanted liquidity. With us, if rates would go up a lot, and we've looked at 3-month LIBOR over the past decades, you know, we would get paid that. So if rates would go up a lot, 3-month LIBOR goes to 4%, we're going to get 4% plus whatever the back end, you know, another 4% or 3.25 or 3.5. So it protects us in a rising rate environment. The key is the credit quality of the institutions. And so we own a lot of those. They've been really hurt, John, because of the credit issue. They have come back incredibly strongly the last couple of days. We were buying some when they got hit. And one that stands out is a Wells Fargo Q. It's a 5.85 coupon, John. It's callable 9/15 of 23. It's a $25 one. I think it dipped down off the top of my head, John. I think it dipped down into the 15 range. A few days ago, it was really hurt. People are concerned about credit quality, and so it dropped down into the $16 range, 16.08, 10.12, and you know, well below par. If you bought it in that range, John, I'm guessing now, because I haven't looked at all this, but if you, in terms of the exact amount, we've looked at them and we've been buying some, but if you bought that and you paid $16, let's say, or $16, let's say $16.50, that's a yield to the call of 23.6%, which is astounding. And even if they don't call it, John, if they do call it, you're going to be made whole. They're going to buy it back at 25. But you have a solid income coming in from a really creditworthy institution for the next 3 years. So that's where we've put a lot of our capital. And we feel they're high quality. As I mentioned, we don't own, it took us 4 years to buy JP Morgan on the fixed income side here. We don't own any Goldman, Morgan Stanley, Barclays, Citigroup, or Bank of America. They probably are all safe, but we just don't own any of those.
Paul, how do you think about capital allocation going forward now that we've had quite a dramatic decline in equity markets? Are you adjusting that allocation between equities and fixed income?
We have. We liquidated some of our fixed income, John. We liquidated probably 15%. Depending on the security, 10 to 20%, and raise several million dollars to create more liquidity. We are looking more at equities. And as I mentioned, you know, no one knows where the bottom is, and companies are becoming more attractive. Having said that, John, many securities were so expensive. We've had a really difficult time over the last 2 or 3 years in particular, with the exception of December of 18. We've had a very tough time finding compelling opportunities. And even now, the market has come down, and you can justify paying a higher multiple given the low interest rates. We still don't think, given their future growth rates, that many of the companies out there are cheap enough. And so, as I mentioned, we purchased three new securities over the last few weeks. We've added and bought for new accounts some of these fixed adjustable preferreds at very compelling prices. But long term, you know, we don't know where this goes. And we've had two really solid stock market days, and it looks like it's doing well today. But even today, we don't think a lot of the valuations are as cheap as we would like. We think when the unemployment numbers come out, when companies start pre-announcing or stating that they're removing any guidance, I think there's a lot more to come. And again, that's on the equity side. I'm even more concerned, John, on the credit side. I think the energy patch and many, many companies in the retail space and elsewhere are really going to have extraordinary challenges. And I think the debt challenges and the credit challenges in the bond market are just going to reverberate throughout the market.
Paul, you've shared some great insights into Berkshire Hathaway with us in the past. I'd love to get your views on how Berkshire is positioned to take advantage of this, and to what extent do you believe Warren Buffett will be deploying that cash hoard here in the foreseeable future?
I think Berkshire, it's kind of interesting. In a small way, John, even though it's very different, certainly a lot more devastating from a health perspective, but also similarly devastating economically to many families around the globe, like the great financial crisis and like 1999, 2000, 2001, the tech bubble. Each of those periods were extraordinary opportunities that illuminate just the risk, the way Mr. Buffett really looks at and assesses risk. In our business, one of the challenges is, particularly when you're managing product, hedge funds, mutual funds, and even separate accounts, but especially product, when that money comes to you from third parties and you don't have direct relationships with the clients, it makes it really difficult as people, when they get scared, pull the money. And that creates all kinds of challenges where you're selling liquidity, you're selling to create liquidity to pay investors when you really want to buy. One of the great blessings that Mr. Buffett has because of his genius is his ability to not have to worry about that. He can choose to continue to stockpile cash and be ready for a rainy day. And so it really turned out to be helpful for him during the tech bubble crisis, as well as during the great financial crisis. And we think that Fort Knox balance sheet now is also going to help him reap similar rewards. And I think it's interesting, almost no one running a mutual fund or hedge fund, there's some exceptions, has that capability. They're always almost forced by clients to be fully invested. And look, we all hate to sit around in cash, especially with the low yields or no yields that they've been providing. But he, Mr. Buffett, one of the many things I've learned from him over the years, he views cash as an option. It's a free option. And you can't focus on the fact that you're not earning much on that cash. What you need to focus on is, what is that availability of cash and what does that liquidity provide you with in times like this? And so I think it's an extraordinary time for Berkshire. Certainly the equity portfolio has really been hit. Apple's way down and the airlines and so forth. But he's prepared. And it also reminds me how each of those three periods, John, the tech bubble, 99, 2001, I think the market was down 2001 and 2, mostly in 2, but all 3 years, and then the great financial crisis, 07, 08, 09, and now he was often, I don't want to say ridiculed, but he was often put down for his conservative nature and not participating the way everyone else was. And he wrote, I think, in his letter last year, maybe in the last couple of years, talking about how they can't find compelling opportunities to buy whole businesses, which is his preference, over even buying stocks. And so I think Berkshire is well positioned. It's our largest holding. It's 15% in that ballpark, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, for almost every account that's been with us for a little while, except for someone who might have just started. We think it's very attractive. We think Berkshire, over time, the Bs have a value of 250 to 300. And a meaningful portion of that is cash. 20% of that value may be cash. So we really like Berkshire here, and we think they're really well prepared to exploit the inevitable opportunities that are going to come about.
And Paul, as we finish up, just one question. You mentioned you haven't been investing in the energy space, and you're focused on wide mode businesses. You cited Google as an example. Where are you finding the most attractive wide mode businesses today?
Some of them, John, are many of the existing holdings we have that we've talked about at length. But the new positions we purchased, believe it or not, we're all in the technology space. Our oldest son, Zachary, has spent 9 years in the technology world, 2 in investment banking and 7 on the sell side covering tech companies. And we think the 3 tech companies that we bought really have the characteristics we like: recurring revenue, they're embedded business models. Two of them in particular, you can't really exist without. One of them, companies can't really operate without it. And so those are 3 that we've purchased recently. So we think software has a long runway. It's fundamentally changing the world. Almost no business today, and we're a good example, almost no business today cannot function without or as efficiently as they need to without high quality software. And it's basically the fuel oil that fuels an economy, John, or it's like the banking system, which is like oil that fuels small businesses with their lending. We think software is now another mechanism that has really embedded itself within the economy. And his insights have really helped our firm in that perspective. And it's twofold. It's not only buying specific software firms, and the majority we wouldn't go near, but it's also enabling us to better understand the business models and the evolution of business models, and to focus on companies, whether they're in insurance, banking, healthcare, diagnostics, whatever. How are they leveraging technology? So it's twofold. It's one, individual software companies we're finding opportunities, and 2, it's helping us better understand companies in a broad range of industries that we already own or are looking to own, and how software and technology and how adaptive they are to use that, because that's what's becoming an important competitive advantage: how you utilize software, data, knowledge to make your business more competitive.
Terrific. Well, Paul, this has been extremely helpful. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and share your perspective with our members.
It's my pleasure, John. Thank you for having me, and all the best to you and your family and all your colleagues.
Thank you so much. Likewise, I want to wish you, your team, and your family all the very best in this period.
Thank you, John. Goodbye for now. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
Good. Bye-bye.